From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. GUI, that's Graphics User Interface, and that's how we use computers today. It means pictures on the computer screen and a mouse to point and click to what we want. This interface made its debut 10 years ago with the Macintosh, and today, this is simply how we all expect to work with computers. Jeff Raskin created the Macintosh project at Apple Computer some 15 years ago. We'll speak with him and find out what his vision was and where he thinks the human-machine interface needs to go from here. I'll also speak with Sybil Parker. She is editor-in-chief and publisher of the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. We'll talk to her about the new multimedia encyclopedia. It all started with the Macintosh, and the Macintosh started with Jeff Raskin. I asked Jeff to tell us how the project began.
Well, I couldn't stand using almost any computer that was around. They're all too hard and over my head. And I'd done a lot of work on how to make things easier back even into the late 60s. And I went to the CEO of Apple at the time, whose name was Mark Markula, and walked into his office. I think this was March or April in 79, which makes it 15 years ago now. And I told him I had this idea for a new computer, and I said, I want to call it Macintosh, because that's my favorite kind of Apple.
At that time, PCs were new. Actually, there weren't any PCs, were they? Personal computers.
No, there were what people called microcomputers. There was maybe a dozen or two dozen brands, and they all worked in pretty much the same way. Of course, we had the Apple II then. It had been on the market for about a year, and you use them all in the same way. You had to type commands into them. You could only get the commands by reading a book or asking someone else who knew. You couldn't see what you had to do. You had to learn it all and internalize it all before you could use them. And there were all kinds of little complications and tricks, and you had to be an insider to make them really work well. And I was pretty sure that you could do a heck of a lot better. There was not only my own research, but also the tremendous work done at Xerox PARC, the wonderful sketchpad system of Ivan Sutherland, Doug Engelbart's work at SRI, which I knew through having been at PARC. And I put a lot of these inspirations together and said, we can make something that's different. And, of course, the people at Apple said, you got to be out of your gourd, Raskin. It doesn't look like anything we've ever seen. It doesn't look like a computer. Can I give you an example of the kind of thinking that was going on, even at Apple in those days? The only kind of I.O. device that we had for mass storage in those days was floppy drive. So I was writing, at that point I was manager of Apple's publications, and I was writing them the manual, and there was this init command. Now, in those days, I pretty much hid the fact that I'd been a professor and a computer center director and had advanced degree in computer science and all that. So I went in, pretending to be all innocent. I said to Steve Wozniak and Randy Wigginton, who were working on it, I said, what's this init command? What does it do? And they said, well, this you use to put all those little marks on the disk, they explained to me, as though I was an idiot, how you have to format the disk, because then the computer needs all these little marks in order to read and write it. I said, well, why can't we, since we're spinning the disk anyway, why can't we just put little marks on and just write and just format as much of the disk and so that the user never has to format the disk? And they thought about that for a little while, and they said, yeah, I guess you could do that. Never thought of that. I said, good, let's do it. And one of them, I don't remember which one, just looked me straight in the eye and said, no, we can't. It's just not done that way. And those exact words, they stuck in my mind. I went back to my cubicle and wrote down the whole episode. It seemed so remarkable. Now, it takes about 2 minutes to write a disk. There's something on the order of 100 million personal computers. Each one has at least 10 floppy disks somewhere. If you multiply all these things out, you get some absurd number, like 50,000 person years of wasted time, all because I couldn't convince these guys that they should do it in a better way. So that was the level of human interface appreciation when I started. So when I started talking about the Macintosh and said, we're not going to have commands, but we're going to do things in ways that really work well with human beings. Well, I'm not going to start with asking what chip we're going to use or what software we're going to use. We're going to ask, what are people going to do with it? How do people work? How do people think? What makes things easy and good to use? And we're going to design, we're going to write a manual for the most pleasant-to-use machine possible, and then we're going to build a machine to match the manual. At that time, the way people designed computers was that they chose their favorite chip and started making a hardware wizardry. And that was fine. That was a good start. But the Macintosh grew from an entirely different background, from a person who came into the company as a writer. I'm a musician, been an art professor. And I wasn't interested. I don't care if it's mice inside pushing little numbers around on the screen and making little drawings. I don't care what's inside the box. What I care is how it looks, how it works for the human being, if the person who's using it is happy.
Well, you do provide, personally, that link between the liberal arts person and that look at the world, and you actually had advanced computer science training. And that doesn't happen very often. I mean, we got to understand that there's a bridge here. what was sort of the core idea you were trying to communicate when you introduced that Macintosh project? What were you trying to say to them?
I started out like a lot of other nerds in my basement shop in my parents' house building electronics. When I was an undergraduate, I actually built from the ground up, you know, the wires and everything, a computer for the biology department at my undergraduate school. And so I did know the insides of computers, but also when I was sometime in high school, I read this wonderful book by Claude Shannon, Information Theory. And information theory did this amazing thing. It managed to connect the physics that I loved and trusted and believed in, because that was something you could get your hands on, and the world of information, the things that I had always had thought were soft and fuzzy and not worth very much, because I had that scientist prejudice against the other side of the world there. And information theory put them together. I remember doing one study where I was looking at the bit rate that you have to read music at in order to sight read something like Chopin. And it's far in excess of what neurophysiologists said that the eye could give to the brain and the brain could process. Said, how in the world can we reconcile this? And because we have information theory on one side, and then we have the actual fact that you're playing at this incredible rate and sight reading on the other side. So then I used myself as a subject and found out that we do it by clumping things. You don't read every note in a chord. You see that's a E flat minor seventh chord, and you sort of just put it all together. So it was after reading Shannon in high school, then I got over my feeling that they were two separate worlds. It was information theory in the deepest and broadest sense. I recommend that book to this day to see how it all fits together.
You know, there have been a lot of books written lately about the Macintosh, and there have been a lot of them written about all kinds of technology. The first book of the genre that I remember reading was way back, The Soul of a New Machine, and it was very romantic, you know, about how it all happened. And I sort of, you know, think of them as romance novels for nerds or something. You know, they're all very romantic. All I remember when I worked on these projects was working hard. What's your take on all these books?
As you say, exactly, you're just exactly right. They are romances. They concentrate on what I think will have the most potential for selling movie rights, is what I think. The personalities, the interactions between the people. You get a real character who's in charge of a project who treats everybody terribly. It makes good storytelling, and a lot of that stuff is true. But every single one of those books, from the Tracy Kidder book that you mentioned, which actually has more of the technology than most, to Levy's book on the Macintosh or Strauss's book on Next, they concentrate so much on the personalities, the interaction, the money, you know, whether that sucking sound was Steve Jobs going on Ross Perot's wallet or something. But they miss the real technological achievements. So if you listen to the books or even some of the interviews I read in the Mercury News about 2 weeks ago, one of the people who worked on the Macintosh project said, we did it all for our emotion and our hearts. No, no. There was a heck of a lot of real work. There was, in the early Macintosh project, we were studying cognitive psychology. We went to the University of Berkeley to hire people who could do the numerical analysis. We had people like Bill Atkinson studying algorithms from state journals like the Communications of the ACM, saying what would be the best algorithm for drawing a line and what's good algorithms for doing string searches. And there's all this computer science going on. There's all this real technology going on. That story is yet untold. Not one of the books looks at the work that had to be done to achieve these things. They make it sound like a bunch of high school dropouts get together and come up with these wonderful things that save billions of dollars and change the way we look at computers and miss the...
If that were true, you could just, if you just eat enough pineapple pizza, you could have a new machine. So I guess you really do have to sit down and work.
I think you just come up with the pineapple pizza theory of machine creation. Very good.
We all agree. Everyone agrees. The Macintosh and the Windows interface is an absolutely preferred interface to deal with the computer over what we did. Are we there? What are the holes? What are the problems?
You have to ask me that? Do you ever use one?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a pain to use. And the Macintosh, which I think is still the best of them in terms of ease of use, trips you up every single day. I still occasionally get a little bomb symbol. I get to some point where I've got to go to the manuals and look up what I have to do. I have, it's sitting right in front of me now, in case I have to look up something, I have a wonderful PowerBook 180, the best computer I've ever owned. Has tremendous potential. But I did not bring along with me the manuals that I have for all the software on it, because that takes up about 11 and one half feet, I measured it, I like facts, on my bookshelves. And if you ask me to demonstrate every feature of every program that I have on here, no way. I get confused, my fingers get all tied up. There are a lot of elementary mistakes. But instead of talking about the Macintosh interface, which is now very complex and messy, can I talk about something a little bit simpler where I can show how you can really improve interfaces?
Yeah.
Because the stuff that I'm working on now is trying to make another order of magnitude of ease of use. In the last 10 or 15 years since the Macintosh, we've learned a heck of a lot about cognitive psychology, learned a lot about the way the mind works and what people are wired to do, what people can do and can't do. And actually, there are many features built into not only the Macintosh, but every graphic user interface, every GUI, mm-hmm. that will not ever be smooth to use. There are certain things that people cannot do.
Like?
But let me take something that everybody, even if they haven't used a computer, may have run into, and that is this problem of their VCR flashing 12. I read a survey that 1 out of 6 Americans still can't set the digital clock on their VCRs, and I question that survey, because is it that they can't set it or they won't set it? I can, I won't.
Why not?
Well, anything so simple as setting a clock that requires me to go back to the manual every couple of months, if I haven't done it for a couple of months since the last power outage, is just badly designed. I mean, the only reason I have such a badly designed thing in my house is that, I use it only to play movies, and it was cheap, and I have a watch. But why can't there be a little circuit in there that just listens to the time signals and sets the clock? I have a wonderful clock at home in my office that listens to WWV, which is the National Institute of Technology. They just changed the name. And it listens to WWV, which is their radio station, and it automatically sets the clock. It changes it for daylight savings time backward and forward. It corrects for leap year. And I have this clock in my office.
Why is it everywhere? It should be everywhere.
I know. It simply always has the exact right time. When I'm listening to the BBC and it goes beep, 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 beep. Well, on that long beep that signals the hour, that second hand hits at the top of the clock. Now, maybe I wouldn't care if it was a minute off in either direction, but the fact that I don't have to ever think about whether that clock is right or not, I never have to set it, is just fine. If TV stations put out amidst all their other signals, every minute they just had a little time code that the receiver could read and use to set the clock. Then you wouldn't even have to tell it what time zone you're in, because you're listening to a station and you want to always work in that station's time zone for doing re-recordings. Why can't the VCRs just always know what time it is? Why do you ever have to set it? So, first thing, we can make the interface a lot simpler. And the second question is, do we need the interface at all? And that's the big mistake with today's computers. We have these graphic user interfaces. They are totally unnecessary. That is the amazing thing, that when you study the subject and you work out how it can be done, we don't need these interfaces. Why can't I just go up to my machine? If I go up to this machine here, I'm going to have to boot. I'm going to get into the desktop. I have to go from the desktop. I've got to open up a window. I've got to go launch programs. Why? Why can't I just simply sit here and start typing? And it says, oh, this person is typing. Clearly, doesn't know what I want to type, but it can certainly know that I want to type. That means I want to be able to backspace, be able to highlight, cut, paste, do all the usual editing things. If I start drawing, if I take my little trackball here and start making lines, it says, oh, this person wants to make a line. It doesn't know whether I want to make a line in a drafting program or whatever, but it doesn't have to care. I actually designed and built a product that did this for Canon in Japan, and it's a delight to use. You go up to it and you start typing. If it's off, the very first keystroke turns it on. If you type, let's say you type 3 plus 4. Now, this might be something that you're just writing, in which case it's just the numbers 3 plus 4, or the numerals, I should say. But if you highlight the 3 plus 4 and say calculate, it suddenly treats it as an expression and evaluates it to 7. If you highlight it and use another command that makes it into a spreadsheet cell, then suddenly you're making a spreadsheet. You don't have to first say, please give me the spreadsheet program, oh great computer, now I will put in this into the cell, and now I want to, you know, it's totally unnecessary.
It's the context of your keyboard. It's the context of how are you using it that it chooses the application.
No, it's what you tell the computer you want to do with it. But you just simply go ahead and do. One of the little breakthroughs in the Macintosh was helping to popularize what's called the noun-verb paradigm, which is where first you give it something to work with, and then you say what you want to do with it. Well, the logical extension of that is that you never have to tell it ahead what you want to do. When you have to select a program, that's saying, okay, I'm going to tell you ahead of time what I want to do. What happens if you then change your mind? You're going to get out of that program into another program.
Yeah.
That's not the way human beings work. Human beings are very bad at thinking ahead and planning, as anybody who's looked at the present world situation knows. And but yet, all computer systems and all GUIs inherently, by the basic design of desktop metaphor, automatically make you choose what you want to do before you have to do it. It's just basically backwards. So what I claim is that to get a lot better, we've actually got to throw out the entire metaphor, the entire system we're presently using. We can do it a heck of a lot better. The problem is that an interface is like an old shoe. The laces are tattered and there's a hole in the bottom, but it's so comfortable you want to stay with it. When people went to the Macintosh, there was a lot of discomfort because it wasn't the way people had done things before. But after they got into it, now it's the old shoe. It's time for a new shoe.
Wouldn't you know it, it's the guy that created the Macintosh project that says, no, we gotta change it. I've never had anybody say it wasn't anything but the greatest. And you're like, nah, we got to go beyond it.
So, well, that was the best we could do then.
We can do better now.
We can do a heck of a lot better now.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Jeff Raskin, creator of the Macintosh project. To interface with Jeff, you can reach him through his email address of Raskin Jeff, that's RaskinJeff at AOL.com. As I was saying earlier, I'm very intrigued by how many disciplines you cross. And usually when I say that to someone on this show, it means that they're both in physics and math, or civil engineering and structural engineering. And what that means for you is that you're also in music and opera and all of this. What have you been doing lately?
Well, I've just completed an article for a science magazine on aerodynamics, and tomorrow I have to go rehearse some musicians for a musical that I just finished the score of, which I'm feeling pretty good about. Tunes keep on going through my head. I'll see if they go through anybody else's head. I like to do a lot of different things. You get different ideas and different perspectives. When I was a kid, I read a lot of science fiction. And one day I said to myself, I have no idea why, that if someday, these flying saucers, which I don't believe really exist, but if one of them ever did come down and pick me up and started quizzing me about this planet and what human beings do, I said, I want to be a pretty good representative of the human race and try to not put aside any part of what it's accomplished, and set myself as a goal to try to become professionally competent and if possible even world class at more than one thing. And so I've done a lot of that. I've been an art professor, had some works at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which is pretty first class. And I've been a soloist with a symphony orchestra with the San Diego Symphony once, and conductor of the San Francisco Chamber Opera Company.
Do you think there's been any cross-pollination between your work in the music and the arts and your work in computers?
For example, if I hadn't tried to make computers back in the 60s, I tried to make them draw music notation. I said, wouldn't it be great if I didn't have to write all these little notes laboriously on pieces of paper? It's a very tedious process. And you want to make a change, you want to add three measures. You have to copy over all that music again to make it readable. And so that turned me on very early to the fact that computers had got to be graphic. It wasn't going to be enough to have them put little rows of green characters on a black screen. My work in art certainly made me open and sensitive to the kinds of things that people would need to do to produce graphics and drawings. The programs I use the most on my own computer, there's three. There's a word processor, there's a drafting program, and I use a CAD package rather than the usual drawing programs, because sometimes I do precision drawings, like when I'm designing airplane parts or something. And the third one is a composing program where I can put notes up on the screen, edit them, as I dreamed of doing when I was a graduate student. And then I can press a button and leave them play it for me so I can check and see if I've put in any clinkers.
Well, I love your toss-up line of, the CAD program when I'm designing airplane parts. We didn't even get over into this area. Do you do windows?
Do I do windows?
Small W. Just wanted to ask.
No, my specialty is that I'm going to try to throw people out of windows.
I see. you've been working with the Exploratorium lately. What have you been working on?
I designed an exhibit, and they built a prototype that's been on the floor for a while. And if it proves successful enough, they're going to make it a permanent exhibit.
That's here at the Exploratorium in San Francisco.
Here at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, which was, I think, pretty much the first hands-on science museum. I always try to do two things with an exhibit. First of all, it's got to be attractive and a lot of fun, because you're competing with carnival rides and television in this world. And trying to convey a message. This one is about wave motion. They have lots of exhibits on wave motion. Most of them concentrate on amplitude, how big the wave is, and frequency, how fast it is. Those are easy, but there's another phase of wave motion called phase, which is a little bit more subtle. And so what I designed is an exhibit where there are two long, we call them planks, which say they're 30 or 40 feet long, and they're moving back and forth slowly. First, the right one is going forward while the left one is going back, and then the left one's going forward while the right one, they just oscillate back and forth. If you put your feet on both of these planks, you'll stand there and your feet will wiggle back and forth. But if you walk with your right foot on the right plank when it's going forward, and then your left foot on the left plank when it's going forward, and keep on doing that, in other words, staying in phase, you'll move forward. It'll work like a moving sidewalk.
Oh.
But if you go out of phase, you'll move backwards. If you go 90 degrees out of phase with it, you'll stay in one place. And so here is something where your whole body can get into phase. Now, we plan to have sound things like right, left. If you go in phase with it, maybe red and green lights blinking up on top. If you go in phase with it, you move forward. Out of phase with it, you move backward. So here's a moving sidewalk where people can go in opposite directions without having to change the direction of the sidewalk.
makes me think of education, where it's, if we can have something visual or something kinesthetic, something whole body is really interesting.
Sound and visual and full body involvement. So I think that even on the prototype, people apparently enjoy using it a great deal, and I think it conveys the idea of phase.
Well, this brings me to, you've been through so much education, so much experience, all of which is very broad. What are your thoughts on education? How do we have to change education in your mind?
More of it.
of any sort.
No, the Martin Luther said, when education flourishes, all flourishes. And I think that that's true. And I think that, along with many other commentators, that we should be spending monies on schools and libraries and not on prisons, because the problem is not with capturing people after they've lost their way, but helping them find their way. And the way to do that is with education. So if I were doing things where I put my own time and energies, is into working with schools. I do that a great deal. I'll teach individual courses, write-up courses, working with a group in Chicago on a mathematics course. So where does education? Education is a hands-on, labor-intensive thing. You can use computers, but they don't save any time or energy on the part of the teacher. They just simply give a whole new set of resources for the student.
I think people would expect you to say that computers are going to solve everything. The guy that, you know, created the Macintosh project is going to say, we just put enough computing power in front of these kids and we'll be able to teach anybody. And I don't believe that, but I'm not sure. I think people would expect you to say that.
They only expect that if they haven't been in the schools and watched teachers and students working together with computers, and then trying to watch students working without teachers on computers. Sure, once a student has been given self-confidence and enough background so they can take off, sure, they can spend lots of hours with a computer and do some very valuable things. So can they with a book. So can they with pencil and paper, working on some mathematics project. And I have three kids, and the youngest is just a little bit under two, and they all love to play with the computer, and they're doing different things. The oldest was working out strategies for winning certain games and is doing some decent mathematics and interesting stuff, and also playing games, of course. And the six-year-old is beginning to learn how to make words, just learning how to read and write, and plays games with it. And the littlest one shows that she can crash it no matter what. It's wonderful.
She'll be a tester uh-huh. in her later years.
But also, she likes to put up letters on the screen. I know that it certainly helped my kids learn. But on the other hand, I spend 3 or 4 hours every single evening with my kids working on their homework, working on their music lessons, and the computer stays off almost all the time. And perhaps more importantly in my house, the television set stays off almost all the time.
You are a lifelong student. I mean, you still are a student.
Absolutely.
How did it happen for you?
That's a wonderful question, because it reminds me of an absolutely wonderful teacher that I had. His name was Roland Genise. He lives in San Jose. And I had him in 6th grade and 7th grade. He was an ex-phys ed teacher who decided to teach mathematics. He was one of the best math teachers I've ever seen or even heard of. But he would say wonderful things like, I'm from Missouri, show me. He would never indicate whether you were right or wrong. When he said, you come up with a problem and say, here's my solution. He said, yeah? Whether it was right or it was wrong.
It's your solution. It's,
exactly. He would say things like, if the world's greatest mathematician came through that door, this after some kid put a proof on the board, and he had 6th and 7th graders doing proofs and not just manipulative arithmetic, and said that proof was wrong, you'd be right and he'd be wrong. And, wow, what an empowering thing. He would take a class full of kids who would begin the class sort of sitting there with a newspaper over their face or something, and by the end of the term he'd have every single kid loving mathematics.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Moira, for sharing your audience with me.
My guest today has been Jeff Raskin, creator of the Macintosh Project. If you're interested in further dialogue on the human-machine interface, you can contact him through his email address, raskinjeff, R-A-S-K-I-N-J-E-F, @AOL.com. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Sybil Parker is the publisher for Science and Engineering at McGraw-Hill. They've just come out with a multimedia version of their Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. I asked Sybil what's happening to encyclopedias today.
Encyclopedias are probably never going to be the same. I don't see a future without them, but I don't see a print product too far down the line. I think that encyclopedias are coming alive, which is kind of a nice thing because it's a very dead and static presentation over the years. You think of the old monks putting together the encyclopedias behind their little closed doors. I don't think the print product is something of the 21st century, very honestly. I think now we can make them dance and sing and move and interact.
Now, when we say multimedia encyclopedia, what does that mean?
It means you bring it to life. It means you have graphics, you have audio, you have animation, you have video sometimes, and you have many things beyond the printed word, which are visually enjoyable.
Okay, now what do people need to use a multimedia encyclopedia? Do they need a computer?
They need a computer. They need a CD player. It would be nice if they had a sound card and some speakers, because then they can really take advantage of it. Beyond that, it's pretty plain vanilla.
So, in addition to all the text and occasional pictures and illustrations, what else is on there?
We have audio to the extent that it's used to illuminate the information. Our audio is strictly focused on narrations for the animations. We're not using sounds just for the audible quality of the information, but sounds as they reflect content.
So people are speaking.
People are speaking. We're narrating the animations, and we're able to give you a kind of a perspective of what's going on the screen while you're watching it happen. And the only other audio is to allow the user to hear the sounds of the English language. We have phonetic charts, and they can interact with the various vowels and consonants, point and click, and hear the sounds.
I know how to use a regular encyclopedia. How is this different?
This is fun. Regular encyclopedia is work. It's study. This is browse and enjoy. It's entering the information from whatever direction you come in from, and it's kind of working your way around to wherever you want to end up without having to feel very structured. It's mind opening. It's spirit lifting. It really is fun. It's learning at the level of fun, which is what makes it so exciting.
There's something very nonlinear about it. It used to be you had to figure out which volume and to go in order. When we just did this example, you were saying, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, yesterday we talked to Francis Crick." And so, click, click.
There
came a bio of Francis Crick. And I said, "Well, what did he write on?" And there it was. And off went two different papers on DNA and the double helix. And it didn't have to, we didn't know where it was in the encyclopedia. So it's basically the kind of interaction, I guess, that depends on what your next question is.
Yeah, and to me it goes beyond linear concept. It's a matter of simple accessibility. I can tell you from having done an acid test on this product that you can now find things in the information that you literally would never have found had you tried to find it in the print product. It depended on where is it in the alphabet and or where is it in the index And if you're lucky to have had the book edited by somebody who's capable, you might find it in one of those two places. Here you just get a chance to punch in the keys, and the word is at your fingertips in a matter of seconds. You can find 10 places in this encyclopedia to find the information you need.
So it's far more cross-referenced than the old encyclopedias.
No, it's not the cross-referencing. It's the search engine that allows you to do it. Every single word that's in the data comprises the index of the database, every single solitary word. So when you want to search, you are searching on thousands and tens of thousands of words. You cannot miss one because they just automatically create it in the file. So an indexer will overlook. I mean, a concept, a word, a piece of information, can't get away with it here.
So every time you're referenced, it'll appear, it will come up.
Every single time, even if it's misspelled.
Do people have to be trained to use this?
I suppose there is a short learning curve, as there is with anything new. The thing we've tried to do here is make it as friendly as possible, as feature-rich as possible, and something that people are familiar with. And that's why we've put it in the Windows environment, because there are many people who are very comfortable with Windows. It's a very accessible interface, and simple point and click around the screen gets the information at your fingertips immediately.
Now, we're used to graphics in books, and now everyone seems to be used to graphics in Windows. Were the graphics any different in this type of a product than they would be in the normal encyclopedia?
They're probably more attractive. we've added some graphic features that are not in the print product, again, because some of the graphic features in the print product are rather boring, not presentable in the environment of a display screen, and we feel we could enhance it by adding. So we created graphics for the product. We created animations for the product. So they're livelier. I can't say that they're more informative because it's just a transition kind of a change, but it is definitely livelier quality on the screen than the same thing might be in a book.
Well, give us an example.
In the area of biology, we found that the print product was relatively weak in good graphic information about the cell. So we went out and created 5 good illustrations, plant cell, animal cell, and the various components of cells, so that we could actually demonstrate this more clearly than we do with the print product. It's, again, information enhancement, if you will. But if the graphic in the book was not good enough, either because it doesn't look nice enough or because the information isn't strong enough, we improved it by adding some graphics. The animations, of course, are the key features in terms of graphic.
Now tell us about that.
A multimedia product, again, is something that comes to life. A book that comes to life has to have something in motion. And besides the actual visual quality, I think that nothing expresses the information, and there's no easier way to learn than to see it animated.
What kinds of things did you animate?
We went through the encyclopedia very methodically, and we had an editorial panel who tried to pass judgment on which is a difficult concept to understand and which is not. We focused on the more difficult concepts if they're theoretical or abstract, and a printed word is just not digestible by an average user. We tried to translate that into something more meaningful. So we gave it an animated quality, tell a little story in pictures, give it a little voiceover narration, and explain what's going on in the pictures, and you bring something very static to life, some very dense, like the subject of damping, which is a very difficult concept to understand for many people. Visually, you can take someone who has no grounding in science and suddenly they can relate to the subject area and understand what damping is.
By seeing it goes,
stops. Yes, it does.
So you need, in that case, those things that are described visually in motion obviously lend themselves to animation.
Well, many of these things don't lend themselves. We've created a motion environment. For example, in the biological area, where we're doing cell divisions or DNA replication, the average person wouldn't be able to see that in motion, or even think of it in motion necessarily. It's a chemical process. It's something that they can't hardly relate to. It's on a microscopic scale. So, again, visualize it. It's visual learning at its best. And I think visual learning is the only thing that we can look forward to in the future.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Sybil Parker. She is the editor-in-chief and publisher of the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science and Technology and the McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms. With 7,300 articles in 81 science and engineering disciplines, 105,000 terms, and 112,000 definitions, have you ever thought about going on Jeopardy?
You know, I watch that program all the time, and I can't answer the question.
You're kidding. How much do
you
know?
I get too
nervous. It's just an enormous amount of information.
I know. They always have the wrong categories. They go into literature and, you know.
But if it could just be science and technology.
Science categories, I do well. Yeah.
You do very
medicine
well in
medicine and science are good for me.
Do you have to go through the entire thing every year?
I go through the entire thing several times a year, actually. There's always some project on the fire that, you know, requires getting in there and massaging the data. So one time we might be reading it for a new print version. One time we might be reading it for a concise version. Sometimes it's electronic products. There's always a reason to be reading that. In my career, I would say that I've read that 10 or 12 times.
The complete encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Now, today when I go to the library, I use the computerized search tools, and I feel much closer to the information. I feel like it's more accessible. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I did this test myself. We had a situation just a few weeks ago as a result of the announcement that the Super Collider would be shut down. And one of my first concerns, as my normal reaction would be, is how does that affect our product? I asked the editor to go and check the text and to make sure that we had identified all the places in the 20 volumes where that text would have to be changed. And he came back with an answer that was very simple. We only have one article. After 5 minutes of thinking, I realized that was a little bit suspect. So I went to the index, which is incredibly well done. And well, it was not in the index. So I couldn't find the term, and he was telling me one article, and then I went to my electronic product. In a matter of seconds, I had five articles listed on the screen, and I had access to all the needs, and I just changed the text. I mean, it's just mind-boggling how useful, how effective this kind of a tool can be.
How many editors work on the encyclopedia?
We have a staff of four, and then we have a whole battery of outside people in terms of consulting editors from various places in the scientific and industrial community around the world to back that up. So the data massaging goes on in-house, so to speak, and we have contributors and editorial consultants from outside all over the world working with us.
How do you manage all that data? I mean, what kind of computer system do you have?
It's all done manually. The age of computers didn't hit the editorial staff yet.
You're kidding.
No, we work on paper, very honestly. The data has now reached a stage where we can massage it because in preparing the electronic product, we had to put it into a database. So now it lives on premises in an accessible database. And we can get in there and play around with the data and massage it spontaneously if needed.
So we need to call you next year and see all the fights everybody have for writing over each other's data.
Right, exactly.
Things are changing.
It's not network. It's just one terminal.
One terminal. Right. Is it one PC?
PC. One super powerful PC.
How big is this encyclopedia?
20 volumes.
20 volumes. Right. And now it's all in one CD-ROM.
It's all on one CD-ROM. It's about 80 to 100 megs, just the text from the encyclopedia. Most of the space on the CD is consumed with the animations, which are enormous as far as being individual files of information. But all of those 20 volumes broke down to only 80 to 100 megs of data on the CD. But we filled the CD, I mean, with one thing and another. We've gone to capacity, which is 660, as you know.
Now, when you sat down to plan this multimedia version, What hit you? I mean, this is
hysteria. it's an enormous undertaking, and it's. I will quote. I won't take credit for this, but I will quote someone in my corporation who said, "This was only undertaken because I didn't understand that I couldn't do it," and that's truly characterizes this kind of a project. It's monumental. There are hurdles every step of the way. You bang into walls every other minute. The technology has to be bent to your needs, so to speak, rather than working with something that's pre-existing, because there's always an exception as to what's been done before and what's needed tomorrow. So we had a fair share of experience here, and it's a long, steep learning curve.
And when did you start this project? And now, of course, it's just...
About 2 years ago.
Took 2 years to bring it to fruition.
Yeah, and that's not extraordinary. A print product can take 5 years. We had a database to work with, so to speak. I guess one of those 2 years almost entirely was spent just in design concept and converting of print data to a digital form of data that we could then use in the electronic product.
So many people have so many different kinds of computers, and some of them have very large computers, but they don't have CD players. How did you address this? You couldn't do one for every different kind of computer. What did you decide to do?
We decided to go for what would support the product best. That's the first thing, and that was Windows PC. DOS was automatically eliminated because of the graphics. And we're used to dealing in a market which, very honestly, has an installed base of PCs. And so it became an obvious choice. A Mac platform is an option. And we can take this data and we can transfer it into another environment very readily. But we're not certain whether there is enough of an installed base of hardware to support it right now.
So right now we're on the IBM PC.
Right now we're on the IBM PC. Plain vanilla. Very plain vanilla, 386, VGA, regular CD player, and a Sound Blaster board.
So basically, you really have a pretty standard kind of computer, bringing an enormous amount of information to it.
Exactly.
Okay, so in addition to those 20 volumes which sit on the shelf in the family room, I would see each year the annual update, and of course they would stop either in a year in which, times got hard or the kids graduated. One or the other. How are you going to handle updates?
It's going to be an annual update. But unlike a yearbook supplement that you keep filling your shelves with, we'll simply massage the entire database. We will be able to update the entire file to the extent that's needed or wanted. And you get a brand new disk. You give us your old one, we give you a new one.
Ah, so there's the physical thing. Instead of having these things lining up, you send in your old CD-ROM, you get the new CD-ROM.
Exactly.
Oh, I like that.
It's just a modest fee. We just exchange disks and you get fresh data.
In terms of this volume as well, I was reading information on the new Multimedia Encyclopedia, and it said, this compact, state-of-the-art, single CD-ROM delivers exhaustive information on 81 major subject areas. And I thought, exhaustive. It's as if you couldn't possibly want to know more than this. In fact, almost like you're exhausted. How deep does the information go?
It's not exhaustive. It's as deep as it needs to go for the subject area. Basically, that's what's driving the level. You take a constellation, and all you really need to know is what is the position in the sky and what are the stars that comprise that constellation and maybe when it was discovered and something very basic. So 200 words might wrap it up. If you want to know what a baryon is or look into elementary particles, you need to walk into it carefully. So we give you a little quiet introduction, and then we go deeper and deeper and deeper until we feel we've reached a level that is still digestible by the average quote-unquote user, but doesn't get you into the monographic side of the subject.
Oh, what does monographic mean?
It means that you would spend probably 20 volumes on just one elementary particle instead of having an entire article on all of them.
So someone who has interest beyond, I'd say, the college level, but this wouldn't be their major, this would be sufficient information.
I guess you could look at it two ways. You would have a user who needs to know something about something they know nothing at all about, or I'm going to just start taking a course in particle physics, let's say. Maybe it's a good place to kind of to introduce the subject to myself, because I can get a broad view, a perspective, if you will, or just a little bit of an introduction. And then maybe I can make that leap into my textbook.
My guest today is Sybil Parker. She's the publisher for Science and Engineering at McGraw-Hill Professional Books. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I was interested, what's an electronic bookmark?
Let me just take a step back before I answer that question. If everyone thinks in terms of a book, they can make the transition from a book to an electronic product very easily. It's a complete metaphorical application. A bookmark is a place marker. And as you would do in a book, where you put a bookmark between two pages and close it up, here you paste a bookmark electronically on a spot and save it on the side, so that you can then come back at some other later point in your search.
I saw that there was all of the information appeared in different windows simultaneously, covering each other, overlapping. So you can say, let's look at this, let's look at that. And of course, it's all right in front of you. If I wanted to take a part of the text and copy it into a word processor, could I do that?
Sure. There's two answers to that question as to why, but first of all, we've tried to make this as friendly as possible. You can clip it to a clipboard, you can download it to a printer, you can put it on another disk if you want to. I mean, it's very easy to take away. Part of it is a very philosophical thing that says, why should I restrict you from using this? If you can have full access to it in print, why shouldn't you have full access to it electronically? Don't expect to take away the animations. Don't expect to take away some of the special graphic maps, but basically 99% of what's on that disk you can take away.
So most of the text you can take away?
All the text.
All the text. Do you see a time when you'll be going to multimedia exclusively?
No, I really don't. I don't really see that happening, because I think that multimedia is a form that is dictated by a need in the market. It's dictated by the information that's going to be in multimedia. Not everything you deliver on a CD requires it to be in multimedia form. There are many products that are strictly database text and very useful in that context.
I remember as a child just very fondly looking at pictures of my mother's encyclopedia, which was in the 20s and the 30s. And I remember really being struck. There was a very large section called The Great World War. And, of course, later on I found out that that was World War One, but they didn't call it World War One because they weren't planning on having World War Two. So I think about how fondly I think of those times, and I don't really think about cuddling up to a nice CD-ROM. Only one person can really use this at a time, and you really have to have the computer going and all that. I mean,
no, you can cuddle up in a network and use it with all of your other friends on different stations. You can't cuddle up with a CD, no. But you can't cuddle up with an encyclopedia either. So, again, it's just a nicer way of presenting what is kind of musty and dusty within the covers of a book, in the perception of some people.
Now, how broad are the topics you're covering in science and engineering?
I don't think we've missed anything. I think that we can truly say that this encyclopedia covers the full spectrum of science and engineering subjects, including medicine, including agriculture, every engineering discipline, every basic biological, physical, chemical discipline.
How long have you been editing this encyclopedia?
25 years. I'm qualified to put it on a disc.
You're loyal.
I'm tenacious.
Tenacious and consistent. I like that. Now, I feel that since every year you're pretty much going through the body of what's going on in science and engineering, what is classically known, what has been, if you were just to try to take a swath, what's the difference between what we knew collectively 25 years ago and now?
The difference is in the level of information, more than the spectrum of information, I think. I mean, I'm not going to come up with too many specifics because it's going to be very embarrassing, but we've been talking about Dr. Crick. I remember reading in the paper when he made his discovery, And that was at a high level of information about DNA and the molecules and all the chemistry involved. We now get down to a very, very fine level of information as far as depth of learning on the specific subjects. And I think that's what really has changed more than anything else. There's nothing that much new in the universe, but we've been able to study it at a very finite scale.
What's more difficult to produce, the 20-volume print set as it was and this version on CD-ROM, now that it's here?
I don't think I can make a comparison that would be meaningful. I think that to produce an encyclopedia of 20 volumes in print is an enormous undertaking, and it has very specific challenges, and they are not to be compared with anything else. And yet I can walk over and look at the electronic product development and say that it follows that same pattern. It's an enormous challenge with its own specific problems. Equal levels of difficulty. There is no question. But everything that comes after this will be simple.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
My guest today has been Sybil Parker. She's the publisher for Science and Engineering and the Professional Books Group at McGraw-Hill. Their latest contribution to information dissemination is the McGraw-Hill Multimedia Encyclopedia of Science and Technology. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Evan's perspective today is called Words and Meaning.
Words have a habit of getting in the way of meaning. For instance, if I say, I am now telling a lie, am I telling the truth or am I lying? If I'm telling the truth, then I'm lying, and if I'm lying, I'm telling the truth. When philosopher Raymond Smullyan was a graduate student, he applied to be a vacuum cleaner salesman. Do you object to telling a little lie? He was asked. He did, but wanting the job, answered no. As he was driving home, he worried that his answer was a lie. Therefore, it was the truth. Alice in Wonderland creator Lewis Carroll loved this sort of nonsense. In Through the Looking Glass, Alice dreams that the Red King is asleep. Tweedledee tells her that the king is dreaming about her, and if that there king was to wake, you'd go out bang, just like a candle. Who is really dreaming? Such puzzles are the stuff of philosophers' dreams. Or is it the philosophers are the stuff of the dreams of such puzzles? I'm not sure. Maybe when I wake up, I'll know. Once you start this sort of thing, it's hard to stop. René Descartes walked into a bar. Would you like a beer? Asked the barman. I think not, answered René, and disappeared. Ancient Greek philosopher Epimenides, the story goes, asked the Buddha, what is the best possible question and what's the best answer to it? The Buddha replied, you've just asked the best possible question, and I'm giving you the best possible answer. By the way, this Tech Nation item is dedicated to those people who do not have a Tech Nation item dedicated to them.
Barry Evans writes the syndicated column Star Watch, and he's the author of Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.